Hello there, and welcome to a History of Horror podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. For our first podcast, I wish to speak to you about the pioneers of cinema. So, originally, I was going to start all this by talking about darkness. The darkness of the cinema and the darkness up on screen. It would be easy to start our story pretending that horror is all about grim violence, dark souls committing terrible things. But film is really the capture of light. And even here, with violent themes and ugly hearts, it's still all about that. True, the celluloid and now the digital print might not be as bright here than in some other genres. There are not as many open plans and bright sunshine, perhaps, as you might see with musicals or, I don't know, nature documentaries. But there's still plenty of light. From the very start, there was the glare and siren call of exploitation to bring people to the screen. Horror is sold with flashing neon and the circus master's call of illicit thrills. Roll up, roll up. We've got the most incredible and shocking sights. Come and see it all. Here's the trailer to American Grindhouse, a documentary from a few years ago that kind of gives you a bit more of a feel for the kind of thing that I'm talking about.
The joke goes that as soon as the movie camera was invented, exploitation started like 5 seconds later.
Everybody was really excited about the movie, which was great, because when I read the script, I thought it was just horrible.
In those days, you know, rent was $85 a month and I couldn't make it, and I had ball tires in my car and no gasoline in it anyway, so just a broke guy walking around Hollywood.
The first phase of operation will be to remove the Messiah.
I never wanted to write the great American movie.
Exploitation basically means there's an element you can exploit. It's something to take advantage of. In promotion, it's a hook to get them into the theater.
We're at the Bijou Theater, where it's been reported that a man has gone berserk while watching a double feature horror program.
No one admitted except at the beginning.
I'm happy to join the management of this theater.
You will take an unforgettable journey down deep into the dungeons of hell.
Why was this girl chosen to be tortured?
This motion picture is a vicious expose of a part of the young generation.
I'm going to give you the time of your life, baby.
Scenes of such brutal honesty will be shown on this screen.
Attention, hungry housewives.
A mixture of tender romance and pornographic realism.
If you're smart, you keep away from prostitutes and pickups. They're not safe, and they can't be made safe.
That's a rude sad knockout.
Shocking scenes you're about to see are not suggested for the weak or immature.
Soon, at this theater, they'll be coming together.
Your chance to see all the bad.
These pictures all have a lot to say, and they're all very interesting. Most of them are shit, but every so often there's a good one.
From the birth of cinema, the specter of exploitation has sat not in the shadows, but bathed in light, shouting for attention. From the very start, we will look at filmmakers setting out to shock and repulse. We're not starting this journey, it's our history of horror, from the sidelines, but front and centre. Our pioneers of cinema knew the importance of getting people in seats, and that is something we'll go back to again and again. So, welcome to the Freak Show tent, the 42nd Street Grindhouse, the Flea Pit cinemas of your childhood. Welcome to the Grotty Video Store, or the VOD offering online thrills. They're all the same, really. Fear, titillation, shock, all on offer. And it all started right back with the advent of film. But first of all, let's just have a quick look at how we got to the stage of actual what we would call today cinema. Well, you could argue it starts in the 17th century, with magic lantern shows, just a flickering candle and a few painted shots on a white wall, telling a tale. In 1827, the first still photograph was taken, using a glass plate technique. Claudine Peace's photograph, The View from a Window at Le Grasse, took nearly 8 hours to expose. Then, in 1832, Joseph Plateau and Sons introduced the venetocoposcope. Pictures on one disc viewed through slots on the other, appearing to move when the two were spun. These days seen as a bit of a child's toy. I mean, it was a fun distraction. But it's these type of distractions and attractions that cinema grew from. In 1888, George Eastman devised a still camera, which produces photographs on sensitized paper, which he sells using the name Kodak. Then, also in 88, Etienne Marais built a box with like a picture camera in it and a mechanism with strips of paper. Edison enters the frame, and by 1891, Edison and his assistant Dixon have their kinetograph camera and kinetoscope viewing box ready for patenting and demonstration. He used Eastman's film but cut inch-wide strips into it, and Dixon punched four holes on either side of each frame, allowing tooth gears to pull the film through the camera. By 1893, Edison and Dixon had built a studio on the grounds of Edison's laboratories, a giant machine that was able to move around again to capture light. It was built in New Jersey and produced films for their kinetoscope. The Black Mariah was ready for film production at the end of January. Over in France, the Lumiere brothers developed their own version, the cinematograph, used flexible film cut with 35mm wide strips, shot films at 16 frames per second rather than the 46 which Edison used. That always makes me smile, only because of the fact that we currently now have the system at 24 frames, but we were filming at 46 with Edison. And obviously these days, when the Hobbit gets put out of 48 frames per second, it's seen as some kind of revolution. And Edison was there doing it first, though obviously not quite as glorious HD. Anyway, 16 frames per second did actually become the standard for cinema before the 24 frames per second, which is a little bit further down the line in the 20s. So we start our journey here. Actually in the films of the 1890s. See, these films were not shown in cinemas because at the time it was a novelty, like a toy. Much like the little game that I spoke about with Plateau. The films of the 1890s were mostly seen via temporary storefront spaces, travelling exhibitors, or as acts in like vaudeville programmes. They needed to offer something different to really stand out from any of the other more exciting things on offer, maybe like a boxing match or a freak show. So at this stage, films were less than a minute long. Now, a lot of people put the first film, horror film, with George Méliès, and we'll talk about him at length soon. But really, the first film for me in my mind was in that first decade of movies. It was from Thomas Edison. The man who gave us the practical light bulb, the phonograph, the motion picture camera. And he also gave us the first exploitation film. The movie was titled The Execution of Mary Stuart. So, it kind of fits with how films were made and looked back then. They were incredibly short. And at first would present just a single static shot. There's no actual like cinematic technique, as the moving image was enough to catch people's attention, and the amount of work that was involved was huge. All compositions were fairly flat, and therefore reminiscent of the stage. I'd say it's also because of that though, and because of the need to get people to view. You know, once you've seen one of these kind of trivialities, you've kind of seen them, so because they're so short and kind of a bit meh. So the idea was to kind of keep things spicy. Because of that, and I'm going to try and stop the novelty wearing off, in the UK, peer shows had peep boxes featuring women undressing, showing once again, you know, what pervs we are. Boxing matches were shown, filmed and shown in places where boxing was frowned upon in America. The execution of Mary Stuart, though, was there to fulfil another need, the love of violence and The film is 18 seconds short, produced in 1895, and the film depicts the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. Now, historical films were a popular genre, very popular in fact, allowing people to see what they couldn't before. It was produced by Edison and directed by a man called Alfred Clark, and may have been the first film in history to use trained actors, as well as one of the first to use editing for the purposes of special effects. The film shows a blindfolded Mary, played by Robert Tommy, being led to the execution block. The executioner raises axe, and with a cut and a prop, the head comes off. The film actually shows finishes with the executioner holding it in his hands, looking quite pleased with himself. As a film, its simplicity is striking, and although hidden behind historical narrative, the plan of the film is obviously to shock. Its entire thing is just to see somebody's head getting cut off, after all. And this need to shock is still successful now. Audiences do not expect this level of violence from films of this age, so it's actually quite surprising, despite its obvious amateurishness. And perhaps because of it, we get a jolt from our own first pseudo-snuff film. We can see how quickly ideas and concepts were accelerating with what many would actually consider to be the first proper horror film, Le Manor du Diable, released in the United States as The Haunted Castle and in Britain as The Devil's Castle. It was from 1896. It was French, short silence, and was directed by George Méliès. The film was like a brief pantomime sketch in the style of like a theatrical comic fantasy. It tells the story of an encounter with the devil and various ghosts. The devil here is the classic trickster version popular in Scandinavian fairy tales. We're not really supposed to be frightened by the exploits in the devil's home. It's a joke. Indeed, we're not supposed to be fearful in the execution of Mary Stuart either. Its aim's just a quick shock. But they both use horror tropes to get a reaction. The Haunted Castle was filmed outside in the Guardian of Méliès property in Montreal, Seine at St. Denis, with a painted scenery, using the light of from outside rather than what Edison was doing, which is kind of capturing it in a darkened room and using and the kind of moving round the sun and chasing the sunshine. The film was released in Méliès Studio, by Méliès Studio, commonly known as the Star Film Company, and number 78 to 80 in its catalogues. We don't know if it was released in 96 or the beginning of 97. But the film is the type of thing he became known for. A bat circles the room before suddenly changing into the devil. He magics up the cauldron and an assistant who help him conjure up a woman from the pot. The rest of the story is taken up with two cavaliers who are tormented, mainly using jump cuts by the devil, throwing them around the room. The film was notable for its length of time, clocking in at over 3 minutes, which kind of makes it stand out considering that we were talking about only 18 seconds from Edison's the film the year before. The Haunted Castle was actually remade in the UK by George Albert Smith in 1897, but he did not have the mastery of Méliès' efforts. Indeed, a lot of the tricks were done in camera using wires. And Méliès' big raison d'etre was obviously to use the artistry of the theatre and link it with what was at the time incredible technical leaps from the cinema. Well, Edison gave the world the means. It was Méliès who first offered up the world of possibility that cinema contained. Before his touch, the genre seemed trivial, focusing on documentary ideas, but under his stewardship, he gave the world the fantastical elements of the cinema. Méliès was a prolific innovator in the use of special effects. He accidentally discovered the substitution stop trick in 1896, and was one of the first filmmakers to use multiple exposures, time-lapse photography, dissolves, and hand-painted colour in his work. Because of his ability, it seemed to seemingly manipulate and transform reality through cinema. Méliès is sometimes referred to as the first cinema magician. As a child, he would be disciplined by his teachers for drawing. He grew obsessed with stages and puppetry, and as a young adult, developed a lifelong passion for stage magic while living in London. He made his home in France though, and when his father died, he sold his share in the family business and entered the world of theatre magic. On the 20th December 1895, Merrys was present at the first public screening of the Lumiere Brothers' films at the Salon Indien du Grand Café in Paris. He did offer to buy one of Lumiere's cameras, but they refused. So he travelled to London and bought several films and an animatograph film projector from inventor Robert W. Paul. By April 1896, his theatre Robin Houdini was showing films as part of his daily performances. Merrys directed over 500 films between 1896 and 1913, ranging in length from 1 minute to a staggering 14 minutes. These all had elements of trick photography about them. His reputation was for tricks for the sake of them, though, and it was that which would eventually become his downfall as people became more sophisticated in their tastes. That said, Merrys created one of the most iconic images of the birth of cinema, including the scene in which the spaceship hits the moon's eye. Merrys made his most famous film, A Trip to the Moon. By 1908, Edison had fought to create a monopoly in cinema. His solution was the Motion Picture Patents Company as a way to control the film industry in the United States and Europe. The companies had joined the conglomerate were Edison, Biograph, Vitagraph, SNA, Serge, Libin, Callum, American Pathé and Merrys Star Company, with Edison acting as president of the collective. Star Films were obliged to supply the MPPC with 1,000 foot of film per week, and Merrys made 58 films that year in order to fulfill his obligation. The result was a machine that was to damage Merrys creatively. In early 1909, Merrys stopped making films, and in February presided over the first meeting of the International Filmmakers Congress in Paris. Like others, he was unhappy with the monopoly that Edison had created, and he wanted to fight back. The results of the meeting were agreements to no longer sell films, but only lease them on four-month contracts, and only to rent films to members of their own organisation, to adopt standardised film perforation count on all films. And Merrys was troubled by the second decision, as he's still mainly shifting products to fairgrounds and music halls. His brother, Gaston, travelled the world filming, but a lot of it was useless. By the end of his travels, Gaston Merrys had cost $50,000 and had to sell the American branch of Star Films to Vitagraph. Gaston eventually returned to Europe and died in 1915. He and George Merrys never spoke again on his return, though. When Merrys broke his contract with Pathé in 1913, he was too broke to pay back all the money that he owed the company. War broke out, he lost the studio, went bankrupt, and never filmed again. Merrys ended up selling sweets in a train station, but eventually George Merrys was made a Cavalier de la Légion d'Honneur, the medal of which he was presented to him in October 1931 by Louis Lumiere. Lumiere himself said Merrys was the creator of a cinematic spectacle. Sadly, he did not have his finances though. He worked like an absolute Trojan in that hot and sweaty or freezing cold, depending on time of year, railway station, and died of cancer in 1938. His story now is probably most famously, apart from obviously in textbooks and in the history of cinema, with the popular public, with Martin Scorsese's Hugo.
What's your name, boy?
Hugo. Hugo Cabret.
A memory from his past.
Who built him?
I would think a magician. The most complicated one I've ever seen.
Can we fix him?
Of course we can fix him.
A mysterious connection.
Hey! Where did you get this?
I need it to fix something.
This is marvellous.
A secret.
What is that?
I think it's a message from my father.
Why would my key fit into your father's machine?
To finding his way home.
This is a treacherous place, do you understand? Watch your step.
We could get into trouble. That's how you know it's an adventure.
You've tried to forget the past for so long. Maybe it's time to try and remember.
The story's not over yet.
This Thanksgiving, Academy Award-winning director Martin Scorsese invites you on an incredible journey.
Stop that child! Apprehend!
Once upon a time, I met a boy named Hugo Cabret. He searched to find a secret message.
I need to know what this means.
And how that message lit his way.
Hugo!
All the way home.
Hugo.
While Méliès was continuing to sell to music halls and festivals down at the start of the century, film elsewhere was moving on. Comparing this to Edison's own Frankenstein shows, how narrative cinema pre-war had leaped. Frankenstein was made in 1910 by Edison Studios and was written and directed by J. Searle Dawley. The 16-minute short film was the first motion picture adaptation of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. The unbilled cast included Augustus Phillips as Dr. Frankenstein, Charles Ogre as the monster, and Mary Fuller as the doctor's fiancée. Although horror, the production was deliberately designed to focus more on magical, mystical and psychological elements of the tale. This can be evident in its ending, when Frankenstein's love for his bride is at its peak. It would mean that his monster will no longer exist. The monster, broken down by his unsuccessful attempts to be with his creator, enters the room, stands before a large mirror and holds out his arms. Gradually he fades away, leaving only an image in the mirror. Frankenstein enters and his image is seen of the monster in the mirror. In a conclusion that would please many a foolish producer, it is love that wins the day, and love erodes the monster's reflection back into Frankenstein's. Dawley, working for the Edison Company, shot the film in 3 days at the Edison Studios in the Bronx, New York City. Some sources credit Thomas Edison as a producer. It is his studios, and this is a keen and extravagant production, so it's possible. For many years, this film was believed to be a lost film. In 1963, a plot description, pre-printed, and stills were discovered published in the March 5th, 1910 issue of an old Edison film catalogue, the Edison Kinetogram. In the early 1950s, a print of this film was purchased by the Wisconsin film collector Aulus F. Detelaff from his mother-in-law, who also collected films. He did not realise its rarity until many years later. Its existence was first revealed in the mid-70s, though somewhat deteriorated. The film was in viewable condition, complete with titles and tints, as seen in 1910. Detelaff had a 35mm presentation copy made in the 1970s. Speaking in the American magazine in February 1930, Edison said his favourite movie was Birth of a Nation. He thought that talkies had spoiled everything for him. There isn't any good acting on the screen. They concentrate on the violence now and have forgotten how to act. I can sense it more than you because I am deaf. His impact on cinema was greater than he even imagined that. Motion Picture Paints Company was, as mentioned, a monopoly. He drove people from New York East. Many independent filmmakers who controlled 1/4 to 1/3 of the domestic marketplace responded to the creation of the MPPC by moving their operations to Hollywood, whose distance from Edison's home base in New Jersey made it very difficult for them to enforce their patents. From here we see the birth of what we consider to be the modern American studio system. We're away from talking about that much just yet, though. They travelled as far away as they could, where they had as much light as they could capture in California sunshine, but where they concentrated on plenty of stories that focused on darkness. Eventually, anyway, it took time to reach that stage. It's here that the Universal Monsters grew, something we'll definitely talk about in episode 3. But that wasn't the start of the monster characters in horror. Indeed, not even Edison can lay claim to that with Frankenstein. It appears that Quasimodo, from Victor Hugo's Notre Dame de Paris 1831 novel, became the first horror figure in with a 10-minute short by female director Alice Guy Blash, entitled Esmeralda, in 1905. There are two characters in the film, Esmeralda, played by Denise Becker, and Quasimodo, played by Henry Vorons. The film is the oldest film adaptation of the novel. Alice Guy Blash was the first woman director in the motion picture industry as one of the first directors of fiction films. Incidentally, Guy's career of 24 years of directing, writing and producing films is one of the longest careers of any of the cinema's pioneers. From 1896 through to 1920, Guy directed over 1,000 films, some 350 of which survive, and 22 of them are feature length. Guy was one of the first women, along with Lois Weber, to manage and own her own studio, the Solax Company, though she barely gets a mention and few of her films survive in a way that are easily viewable. Unsurprisingly, her work with Charlie Chaplin is easy to find. So it kind of shows that even then, cinema was a bit of a boys' club. And sadly, cinema history hasn't given her, as one of the main pioneers, quite the credit that she deserves. But she is almost certainly one of our pioneers of cinema, and because of her, the 10-minute short, definitely a pioneer of horror. In 1911, the story was turned into a full-length horror film, Notre Dame de Paris, also known as The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Albert Campolini created it. Now, he was a French film director and screenwriter of the silent era, focused entirely. He directed films, in fact, from 1905 to 1922. And his brother was the actor and sculptor Paul Campolini. Another notable element that started cinema was the French silent revolution, the French film serial, Les Vampires from 1915, also known as The Vampires. That was from director and writer Louis Fouliard. That's it. Film serial focuses on vampire thieves who suck the blood out of sleeping bourgeois Parisian society and then stole their jewels. Film series were popular at a period in time when it was a night in the cinema would involve seeing a selection of shorts rather than necessarily one feature film. Indeed, there weren't that many feature films on offer. And particularly in the UK, these kind of serials were very popular, as people did tend to watch bits, elements of Pathé News and elements of short films, and particularly comedy. The villainous leader of the monsters was Irma Veep, which is an anagram for vampire. The partly scripted, partly improvised episodes had great names. They had titles like The Severed Head. And they followed an investigative journalist called Philippe Junard, played by Edouard Maffei, and his comic sidekick, Oscar Mazamet, played by Marcel Leverick, in their attempts to foil the vampire gang schemes. It's at this time, in the mid-1910s, that Hollywood begins to grow, although their interest in horror is small for a while. For our history of horror journey to continue, we must travel to Germany, see where the more interesting work of the 1920s is. We'll examine how they influenced us next time. So our introduction to cinema then seems a strange one. One that spans the Atlantic. We have two big hitters, one in America and France. Though you could argue that neither side really was interested in horror as much as the fantastic. When we see gore, we see it in fleeting, almost unintentional moments. There are far more moments when I mentioned here that do show elements of traditional horror, though. Take, for example, The Avenging Conscience, or Thou Shall Not Kill, from 1914, which is more of a drama directed by D.W. Griffith. The film is based on Edgar Allan Poe's short story The Telltale Heart and the poem Annabel Lee. A young man, played by Henry B. Walthall, falls in love with a beautiful woman, Blanche Sweet, and is prevented by his uncle from pursuing her. Tormented by visions of death and suffering, and saying that murder is the only way of things, the young man kills his uncle and builds a wall to hide the body. He starts to go mad, and gradually loses grip on reality. The police figure out what he's done, chase him down, and in the ending sequence, we learn that the experience was all a dream, and his uncle is really alive. Here, Griffiths is far more interested in guilt than shocks, and focuses more on murder mystery than with a supernatural edge. He's also prone to revert to the fact that all is right with the world at the end. Far more morbid and macabre was his 1909 effort, The Sealed Room. The film's film of immurement draws inspiration from Balzac's Le Grand Bretache and Edgar Allan Poe's The Cask of Amontillado. The king constructs a cosy, windowless love nest for himself and his concubine. However, she is not faithful to her sovereign and consorts with the court troubadour. In fact, they use the king's new play chamber for their trysts. When the king discovers this, he sends for his masons, with the faithless duo still inside. The masons use stone and mortar to quietly seal the only doors to the vault, suffocate their lovers, and the film ends. This is horror of exploitation again, a ghoulish tale featuring sex and death. Filled with horrors, inviting you to imagine incredible and terrible things. It was D.W. Griffiths that created Edison's favourite film, Birth of the Nation. Although it has to be pointed out that now the film could see the horror film rather than a historical drama because of its politics. The film follows the relationship of two Civil War families and Reconstruction US era, the pro-Union North Stonemans and the pro-Confederacy Southern Cameroons over the course of several years. The film was a success at the time, but was highly controversial owing to the portrayal of black men as potential rapists and dumb, all done with black face makeup, and the Ku Klux Klan as a heroic element. It seems apt that we finish this part of our journey here then. We started with an historical film that played like horror, and we can do that here too. Even as likely neither side wished their films to be seen in that way at all. Right, well, thank you very much for listening. This is our first episode, so hope you enjoyed it. Not a lot of clips in there, you might have noticed. Obviously, unsurprisingly, because it's very difficult to clip a silent film. On the plus side, though, if you go to historyofhorrorpodcast.com, there are lots of videos that I've put online which kind of show the show clips or elements of some of the films I've spoken about, or indeed the entire film. So, kind of like a something to kind of really kind of you know, help you along on this journey, because I'm aware, obviously, that I'll speak about lots of things that you may not have seen, and might. So it's an easy kind of repository for you to get a good feel for the movies I'm talking about. Thanks for everyone who's been very patient, the listeners from my last podcast, videonastiespodcast.com, who've patiently waited for me to kind of get ready for this podcast. It's kind of taken roughly around the time I kind of thought it would. If you're wondering where our journey takes us, if you go to the website, you can also see a list, like an episode list. So it is mapped out, although that's kind of free form, as our discovery and time periods may slip and change, and I might find something completely different to talk about, and that would boost the numbers. Our podcast is going to be fortnightly because this takes longer to write and implement than some of the stuff I've been doing previously. So sorry about that. And yeah, we're going to be looking running about between 30 minutes and 45 an episode, I think. We may go longer, we may go shorter, we'll have to see, depending again on where our journey takes us. So thanks to everyone for the kind words. If you want to hear more from me, you can do. If this is the first podcast you've listened to of mine, fans of The Night Gallery, Rod Serling Show, can listen to The Night Gallery podcast, along with a whole range of suite of different podcasts over at the Gentleman's Grindhouse records.com website. There is that there, and also some podcasts I have an occasional hand in, very occasionally sending feedback to, if nothing else, in particular The Strange and Deadly Show. Now, fans of my other podcast, The Video Nasties podcast, which is available on videonastiespodcast.com, will be able to kind of flick over to that, and they'll listen to Chris and Tom's opinions on the Section 3 Nasties list. So that's great. However, all my stuff for this podcast is hosted over on, as I said, a History of Horror podcast, mainly so I get, there's a lot of space I need to kind of like put loads of videos in and stuff like that, so it makes sense to sit on its own, under its own URL. Easiest ways to get hold of me is through Twitter, it's @orange_monkey, or through email at historyofhorrorpodcast@gmail.com, or indeed you can leave a message on any of the articles that are up on the website. Thanks very much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with me, please do. I'm not exactly sure how we can work this, because, normally this kind of thing, you would kind of say the film you're covering next and people could watch it, or, you know, people with their own opinions would be able to kind of contact you and say, you know, oh, yeah, no, I love these films. But really, because of the way this is, it's more like, genres and themes and ideas. So, but if you have any feelings on what I've said today, let us know, and I'll read them out in the next episode. Or if you've got any feelings on German silent cinema, so Dr. Caligari, Nosferatu, The Vampire, stuff like that, then let me know, and I can read it out next week. But anyway, next time we're going to be talking, as I said, about Germany's silent film revolution, and some of the first real creative and real artistry in horror, and while the Melies stuff kind of gives us some of the tropes that you see that go throughout horror, you know, vampire bats and whatever, the real, like, the element sense of dread really gets born out of 1920s Germany. And that's probably not surprising considering where the country was at that time. But we'll talk all about that next week. So, until then, take care. I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.